Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the uncontrolled outbursts that spewed from President Trump at a rally in Mississippi last night as he belittled Dr. Blasey Ford, who testified against Judge Kavanaugh. Despite having been repeatedly cautioned by his handlers not to inflame a delicate political situation as Kavanaugh's fate hangs by a thread, Trump clearly could not restrain himself, and his vitriolic mockery of Dr. Ford offended the very senators who are the swing votes Trump needs to seat Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court. Joseph Cerincione, the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons, joins us to discuss the danger of having a president who cannot control himself but has access to the nuclear button. Although we have been lucky, the country has not faced a crisis so far. The fact remains that Trump has the power at his fingertips to destroy the world. We'll assess the difference between a Trump administration full of unqualified amateurs, like Ambassador to NATO Kay Bailey Hutchinson, who just threatened to, quote, take out Russian nuclear missiles on their territory, and how President Kennedy handled the Cuban Missile Crisis by overruling his hawks, who recommended a nuclear strike, which would have led to a nuclear war. In contrast, if a real crisis struck, an erratic and uncontrollable Trump would be goaded on by his hawks, John Bolton and Mike Pompeo. Then we will speak with an historian of American political discourse and presidential rhetoric, Jennifer Machia, a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M University, about the response to Trump's mockery of Dr. Blasey Ford from the three key senators whose votes he needs to confirm Kavanaugh, Senators Flake, Collins, and Murkowski. We'll discuss whether there is still an expectation among the American people that their head of state exhibit decorum and dignity, or are we back to the days of Andrew Jackson, with the difference being that Trump does not settle scores with dueling pistols, but rather uses Twitter to insult and demean his enemies, real and imagined. Then finally, we'll explore both the constitutional authority of the President of the United States and the constitutional restraints imposed on his authority, and speak with Corey Brettschneider, a professor of political science at Brown University and author of the new book, The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. He joins us to discuss whether, while California develops its own foreign and immigration policy and signs international climate treaties, a president under investigation can pardon himself, fire anyone in the executive branch, or wage war without congressional approval. And joining us now is Joseph Cerincione, the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously directed nonproliferation and international policy programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and has also worked on the professional staffs of the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Government Operations, and served as staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joseph Cerincione.
Thank you for having me back on, Ian.
Well, thank you, Joe. And you're an expert on nuclear weapons and nuclear systems. And we and the Russians, of course, have thousands of nuclear weapons. But at the end of the day, it comes down on our side to the football, the briefcase that military aid carries at all times beside the president. On the Russian side, they have the cheget, which is the mirror of our football. So when you see a president, as we saw last night at a rally in Mississippi, railing against Dr. Blasey Ford, and we all know that his aides have been restraining him for weeks, and there's been a lot of coverage about how well he's behaving, and that he's not attacking her and not doing what he normally does. And, of course, there's a lot at stake for him with getting Brett Kavanaugh on the court. But he obviously cannot control himself. And then he just had this outburst, and now, of course, some of the key swing votes in the Senate, like Jeff Flake and Susan Collins, are first to decry what Trump has done. So, to my mind, what this says is that we have a president who cannot control himself. How do you see it?
I get very worried about national security threats every time I see the president take the podium at one of these rallies, and I see the way he winds himself up and the emotion that he sort of spirals up within him into this anger and this rage and this self-certainty. And then, you know, it's reinforced by the crowd, which is just cheering him on. I mean, this is a spectacle unlike anything we've seen in America before, at least in a president. We've never seen a president act like this. And he has an unparalleled amount of control over the most destructive military machine the world has ever created. So you're worried about two things, basically. One is whether he will do something that will start a war, that it will start a new war with Iran, for example. And the other is whether he will do something that would start a nuclear war, because the President of the United States has sole unfettered authority to the world's nuclear arsenal. And let me give you an example, just so this isn't just hypothetical. Late July, the president, in the middle of the night, it was around midnight, he tweeted out a threat to Iran in all caps. He threatened Iran with, quote, consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered, close quotes. Well, the problem is, of course, the President of the United States has the ability to, at a moment's notice, inflict consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered. He controls the nuclear arsenal. At all times, a military officer follows the president around. He's required to be within a minute of the president. So when the president is tweeting in the Lincoln bedroom, this officer is sitting outside the door, and the president can summon him at any moment. He carries a briefcase with the nuclear codes and communication equipment in it. The president can order him to open up that briefcase to connect him to the military command authority, and the president, once he identifies himself, can deliver an order to launch a nuclear weapon at Iran. Now, this is a system that was set up to protect the country, but we've never had a president like this, this volatile, this unstable. So, yes, the president's behavior at these rallies as he rails against his political opponents, real and imagined, gives me great fear about whether he's going to plunge America into a new war.
Well, but I think it's worse in the sense, Joe Cerincione, that we know that his aides have been trying to restrain him. They've obviously had lots of conversations with him. Do not trash this woman. And he's been fairly sober about it. He said nice things about her. So to my mind, this really shows that he simply couldn't stop it, what he was told not to do.
Yes. That he breaks through the restraint. He can't help himself. That's
right.
Exactly right. And so what happens when he's in a situation where his aides are actually egging him on? So in the case of Iran, and you've seen speeches and threats and rhetoric in Iran escalating daily, and that's because he now has aides, National Security Advisor John Bolton, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, that want to provoke him, that are as rabid as he is about Iran. That's what makes this situation so dangerous.
And again, I'm speaking with Joseph Cerincione, who's the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously directed nonproliferation and international policy programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's also worked on the professional staff to the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Government Operations, and served as staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. So in terms of what you were saying about the football, the nuclear codes with the military aid within a minute of the president at all time. So as he tweets out at, you know, 3 or 4 in the morning, there's this man sitting outside the door with his suitcase. So there is no impediment, is there, between the president and the suitcase, the football? In other words, the codes are in there. I know how it was set up during the Cold War for an incoming attack. Immediately, NORAD would pick it up in Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado. Then they would immediately alert the National Command Authority, the Pentagon. The Secretary of Defense would be alerted and immediately alert the president. How does it operate in the opposite direction? In other words, if it's not an incoming strike, but still he has the authority to launch nuclear weapons, offensively or preemptively, so what's to stop him?
Nothing. which is the scary part. And people don't believe me when I tell them this, because they're all used to seeing the scenario play out the way you describe, that there's an incoming attack, and then, of course, that the military picks that up first, and then the phone calls start. And by the time they get the president on the line, there's already a group of national security officials who are on the line with him, and they're allowed to have a brief conference, and that's the way the system is supposed to work. But it doesn't have to be the military calling the president. The president can call the military. And in that case, there's no set procedure, no requirement for the president to loop in his national security advisor or secretary of defense or secretary of state or even the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. The way the system works is that he gets connected immediately to the national command center, where the only thing that is required is that the officer in charge, and usually it'd be a three-star general, would then query the president with a challenge code, and the president would pull out the card that he's required to carry with him at all times, called the biscuit, where he then has a code to answer back, say Alpha Delta Bravo 7. And then once he's identified as the president, well, then he can give the command. And so the book that he carries around, the book that's in the nuclear football, is like a Chinese menu of nuclear options, you know, from one up to 1,000, with different target sets that he can choose, and these all have codes. And now, so he would then give that order. He would order a particular attack. This actually was all illustrated brilliantly in a recent episode of Madam Secretary on CBS. It was their season finale, just rebroadcast a couple of weeks ago, which shows the actual process that goes through. In this case, it was a false attack that was called off at the last minute, but it shows the process. At that point, the commander of the Military Operations Center would then contact the Strategic Command, where they actually implement the order. And so then another general will be brought on board. But that's it. That's all that's required. And as long as the order was legal, and by the fact that these operations are actually in the book, they're sort of pre-vetted to be legal. And you can imagine, for example, in a time of crisis with Iran, or for that matter, North Korea, if tensions are building and suddenly the general gets an order that the president is ordering a nuclear attack, they would implement that order. They are trained to implement the order. The whole process is built for speed and implementation, not for discussion and debate. So it would require a full-scale mutiny by the military in order to stop a nuclear command given by the president, even one as unstable as Donald Trump.
So I think the point is, though, surely, Joseph Cerenzioni, that we've been lucky so far that we haven't had a real crisis. And we know that many presidents have been tested by a real crisis, going back to JFK with the Cuba crisis. And the hawks, like the head of Strategic Air Command, Curtis LeMay, were badgering JFK to launch nuclear weapons against Cuba. And that would have, and we now know in retrospect that the Russians on the ground in Cuba had the authority to retaliate with the nuclear weapons that they had there. So,
yes.
And then, of course, that would have led to a wider exchange of nuclear weapons. And Curtis LeMay got so mad at Kennedy that he was telling everybody the guy's a wimp and a wuss and all this stuff.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly what happened. Yeah. We knew that there were missiles on Cuba. We did not know and didn't find out for years later that there were also 150 nuclear warheads deployed in and around Cuba that could be mated up with those missiles, and that the commanders on Cuba had the authority to fire them. So you're absolutely right. Curtis LeMay and the Joint Chiefs were recommending attack, and there were three men that stopped it from happening: Robert Kennedy, the president himself, John Kennedy, and Robert McNamara. Now, where in this cabinet can you find people like that now? I would say you can't, with the exception of Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis. I don't think any of the other people around the president would be able to restrain him or talk him out of an order to fire.
Well, you just mentioned a little while ago that you were afraid that they may, in fact, do the opposite and goad him.
Yes. And in the case of Iran, I think they would goad him into an attack. And that's what you see. I mean, there's actually a march towards war with Iran building as we talk. Just today, John Bolton was in the took the podium of the White House to break a treaty that we have with Iran that goes back to 1955. It's a diplomatic treaty for consular relations. And he pulled the United States out of it and denounced Iran in the harshest possible talk, which similar to what the president himself did at the podium of the UN last week and speeches that Bolton and Pompeo gave in New York last week. So there is a drumbeat of anti-Iran rhetoric and threats and action that's steadily building up that has a lot of us worried. In fact, you're having members of Congress introduce legislation just last week. Senator Tom Udall introduced a bill to stop a war with Iran, demanding that any action with Iran be approved by Congress first, so that this fear that I'm talking about is not something that just I'm seeing. Lots of people are seeing this, are worried about it, and the more and more volatile and unpredictable and angry and vindictive the president gets, the more worried we are that this will not just be campaign rhetoric, but he might send missiles flying.
Well, there was some rhetoric coming from the U.S. ambassador to NATO, Kay Bailey Hutchinson, which has alarmed the Russians, and I don't know the extent to which it's alarmed the NATO allies, but she set off alarm bells on Tuesday when she suggested the United States might, quote, take out Russian missiles that the U.S. says are violating the INF arms control treaty.
Yes. It alarmed me. My emails exploded over this, and it got even worse when we all read the transcript of what she said. She may not have meant to, but what she did was threaten a preemptive military attack against Russian missiles, nuclear-capable cruise missiles that the Russians are deploying in Russian territory, and she said we would take them out. Now, about 10 hours later, she walked it back and said, no, what she meant was we'd have to deploy countermeasures, we'd have to deploy missiles in kind, which is his own kind of provocation. But it shows what happens when you put in place incompetent, inexperienced people into key military situations. Kay Bailey Hutchinson knows jack about NATO. You know, it's like putting Betsy DeVos in. As education secretary. I mean, these people just don't know the field that they're now being put in charge of, and you can see the kinds of diplomatic consequences that result.
Well, I'm concerned in the broadest sense, since, as you know, and you worked on arms control throughout the Cold War, Joseph Ranciani, and one of the differences now was when we were dealing with the Soviet Union, you were dealing with discipline and ideology that the state had, even though there were some very scary moments. And there was in October of 1993, but for the fact that a Russian missile officer decided to override an automatic counterstrike against the United States based upon a signal that there were five, I think, Minuteman missiles coming in, and he took it upon himself, thought, well, if the Americans are going to strike us in a first strike, they're going to send more than five. So he overrode the automatic thing, and he got demoted. So that's an example of their system or the flaws in their system. But overall, there was a control based upon a kind of ideology and a discipline. I don't believe that there's any ideology left in Russia today. Under Putin, it's just a straightforward thuggery and kleptocracy. So don't we have a fundamental problem here, which we've never had in geopolitics before, which is the combination of national security and organized crime, the mafia and nuclear weapons?
I think you really put your finger on it, Ian. You know, these systems were built up with certain assumptions and that there'd be certain norms followed. And what we've seen in both countries, in the United States and in Russia, is a collapse of those norms and a collapse of the types of governments that would control the most powerful weapons ever invented. And so you now have this kleptocracy, as you put it, this gang of oligarchs in Russia controlling nuclear weapons without some sort of ideology guiding them or even a coherent national security strategy guiding them. And here in the United States, can you identify an ideology that Donald Trump has? Is there coherent set of strategic thinking that he has. I mean, nobody talks about a Trump doctrine or, you know, the incoherence and I would say even insanity of the current leaders of these two countries really exposes the insanity and incoherence of the system they've inherited. It is nuts that each country has 2,000 hydrogen bombs ready to launch on a minute's notice. Why? For what? What military purpose does that serve? Even if you think we need nuclear weapons for deterrence, even if you think we need some to stop somebody else from attacking us, do you need 2,000 of them? Do they have to be launched immediately? Is it really true that one person can do this in both, by the way, Russia and the United States? It's nuts. You could go to much lower levels with much longer warning system, with a much greater requirement for a consensus. Even if you believe these weapons are necessary, you could tremendously reduce the risk with just making some changes in the structure and doctrine. And we're starting to see some, at least in the United States, look at this. Take a harder look at this. Let me give you one example. Adam Smith, the representative from Washington State, has introduced a bill calling for the policy of the United States to be changed to one of no first use. That is, under no circumstances would the United States launch a nuclear weapon first. So prevent the whole scenario we were just talking about Donald Trump getting angry in the middle of the night and starting a nuclear war. Adam Smith would become chairman of the House Armed Services Committee if the Democrats take back the House. So this is a man that might, in a month or so, be in a position to actually do something about this. This isn't some think tank proposal. This is what he believes. So, and part of the reason you're seeing people relook at these issues is because of the concern of the mental stability of the President of the United States.
Well, Joseph Cirincione, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Joseph Cirincione, who's the president of the Plowshares Fund and the author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously directed Nonproliferation International Policy Programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He also worked on the professional staff to the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Government Operations and served as staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. We're going to take a brief station break and back speaking with an historian of American political discourse and presidential rhetoric about whether there is still an expectation among the American people that their head of state exhibit decorum and dignity.
Mother, do you think they'll drop the bomb? Mother, do you think they'll like this song? He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land, making all his nowhere plans for nobody. Doesn't
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jennifer Machia, who's a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M University, where she teaches courses on political communication and presidential rhetoric, an historian of American political discourse, especially discourses about citizenship, democracy, and the presidency. She's the author of Founding Fictions and the co-editor of The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, Establishing the Obama Presidency. And she's finishing a third book about Donald Trump's presidential campaign and demagoguery. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Machia.
Thank you for having me on your show.
And our preceding guest on today's program is an expert on nuclear weapons and the systems around the use of nuclear weapons. And he was expressing a great deal of concern that what President Trump was exhibiting at the rally on Tuesday night in Mississippi was a lack of control, because he's been advised by his aides not to complicate matters. This is a very delicate situation. The Judge Kavanaugh's fate is hanging by a thread, and they have been trying to restrain him and encouraging him to say good things about Dr. Blasey Ford, which he has done up until now. So let's begin with that. Do you think this was an example of a person or a president who simply can't control himself because what he did was against his own interests?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think that what we saw Trump do was absolutely by design and was intended by him. But that's a separate question from whether or not his staff can control him. I don't believe that his staff can control him. In fact, I don't think that anyone can. But I do think that he intended to say what he said. I don't think that was a mistake.
So what would his motive be then?
I think that he's always trying to sow division. He's very interested in polarizing people, us versus them. I think he's probably irritated with the way that the Kavanaugh hearing has played out. It seemed like there was some pressure on the way that he had limited the FBI investigation, and that was expanded, maybe. So I think that it hasn't been playing out the way he wanted it to. And so one way to push back on all of that is to get his partisans and his rally crowd, excited about, saying this woman is a terrible, accuser of things. I don't know what his point was.
Well,
he has a bad memory.
Right, but this is what's extraordinary. There are three swing votes, as far as we can tell. The Democrats have probably got enough political cover to vote en masse against Kavanaugh. But there are three wavering Republicans, Senator Flake, Senator Murkowski, and Senator Collins. Senator Flake referred to Trump's attack on Dr. Blasey Ford as kind of appalling. There is no time and no place for remarks like that. But to discuss something this sensitive at a political rally is just not right. I wish he hadn't have done it. And then Senator Collins told reporters that Trump's attacks were just plain wrong. And Senator Murkowski said that it was wholly inappropriate, in my view, unacceptable. And when asked whether she'd vote for Kavanaugh, she said, I am taking everything into account. So I guess that's my point. You know, if I don't see the strategy of offending the very votes you need.
Yeah, that's a great point. So, I mean, on the one hand, he's impeaching for Dr. Blasey Ford's credibility, right? She's a terrible witness. She doesn't remember, right? And so that could provide cover to someone like Flake, who might want to vote against her, right, and support the Republicans. It's hard to predict exactly how things like that will play out once you say them, right? Mm-hmm. And Flake isn't exactly reliable. He will sometimes condemn Trump and then vote accordingly, right? So it's hard to know how he'll actually perform on the question. But then also, you know, it might not have been these three people who were his audience, his target audience. I mean, when Trump is in a rally, he really enjoys the rally, right? He really enjoys rallying his supporters. And folks have been reporting in the last week that Trump is really looking ahead towards 2020. He's really looking ahead and thinking about this as, you know, his reelection campaign. Rallying his troops has been successful for him so far.
And again, I'm speaking with Jennifer Machia, who's a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M University, where she teaches courses on political communication and presidential rhetoric, an historian of American political discourse, especially discourses about citizenship, democracy, and the presidency. She's the author of Founding Fictions and the co-editor of The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, Establishing the Obama Presidency. And she's finishing a third book about Donald Trump's presidential campaign and demagoguery. So is there, since you have studied presidential rhetoric, Jennifer, I take it there's nothing like this, right? I mean, would you, I know that President Trump has put Andrew Jackson's portrait up on the wall to sort of highlight it in many of his photo ops. Would you have to go back to him, the sort of genocidal Indian killer?
I think that's right, actually. I have written a thing, I think it was in 2016, comparing Trump to Andrew Jackson, and I think that that is the best comparison in American history for presidents. Andrew Jackson was charming by all accounts, particularly with women. You know, he was remembered as a very charming person, and yet also he was a, I can't say the word, I don't think, on your program. He was an SOB, that's the word. Mm-hmm. You know, he was very willing to get into a duel. There's a great and terrible story about him getting into a duel and being so enraged at this person that he decided to not fire his weapon, let the man shoot him, who he knew was a good duelist and a good shot, withstand the fire and then shoot back so that he could kill him, which he did. And when his second, and he left the field of honor, the battlefield, they walked over to a tavern where Andrew Jackson was said to drink some buttermilk, where his second noticed that there was blood running down his leg. And indeed, he had been shot right in the chest, and he had that bullet lodged in his body for the rest of his life, including while he lived in the White House. And the guy said, how is this possible? And he said, oh, yeah, I was determined to kill him if he shot me dead. Trump has that kind of persona, right? He has that kind of alpha male demeanor. He's not willing to stop. He's not willing to back down. You can wonder about whether that's presidential, for sure. And it's interesting because, you know, we sort of have made a hero out of our presidents since we've given them the power to destroy the world, right? You know, we sort of look to this person as they have to be the smartest person. They have to have the best disposition. They have to, you know, be able to control themselves in all these ways because they do have the power to destroy the world. And so what do you do when it's clear that we've elected a person who does not possess those qualities? It's really frightening, and I think it's got a lot of people on edge.
Well, we were just talking earlier with Joe Cirincione about comparing what happened. I mean, we're lucky that we haven't had a real crisis during the Trump these last 2 years. Most presidents have been faced with a crisis of one kind or another. And if you go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was a real one, Kennedy was absolutely badgered by his hawks and his joint chiefs and General Curtis LeMay to strike Cuba with nuclear weapons. And, you know, fairly recently we learned that the Russian military officers in Cuba had authority to launch the nuclear weapons on their own without the Kremlin if there was going to be an attack. So had JFK listened to his generals, the world would have ended back in 1962, or the world would have been incredibly screwed up, shall we say. So compare that to what you have Trump, surrounded by hawks like John Bolton and Pompeo, the only adult in the room, Jim Mattis, the Secretary of Defense. He's on his way out, probably won't be there after the November 6th elections. The difference is that Kennedy was able to be sober and not be swayed by his hawks. Trump is probably going to get goaded by his hawks. They can't wait to go to war against Iran, for example.
Yeah, I think that's a good analysis and a frightening prospect. And it's impossible to know how to predict, you know, how he will respond, right? You know, we know how he is domestically. We know how he is with enemies or people he views as enemies. It's hard to know if he really will use all of the military options available to him, to use a euphemism. but it certainly is possible, especially if he feels cornered in other ways.
Well, just in the last minute or so, Jennifer, returning to the work that you do, what's happened to the idea that the public expect I mean, going back to the founders, of course, there was an argument about whether George Washington should be a king, and they resisted that idea. But the impulse has always been there that the head of state is sort of, you know, a kind of like royalty. Obviously, we don't have royalty. So our presidents are both our political leaders and our heads of state. And there's always been an expectation that the head of state behaves with a certain amount of decorum. Has that been lost in this Kardashian culture? What do you think?
I don't think it's been lost. I think it's not present in this president. He loves a parade, right? He loves the pageantry of things, but I don't think he likes to or does act with decorum. But I don't think that it's lost entirely. I think that there's a lot of people who are nostalgic now for the Obama administration and the fact that there wasn't a lot of controversy or embarrassment on the world stage. And I think that probably we'll be looking for leaders who, you know, sort of possess that kind of decorum.
You think that this is, I mean, his behavior in the UN was just deeply embarrassing, where he made those absurd remarks about how great he was and his greatest president accomplished more in 2 years than any other president in America's history. That was bad enough. But do you think this last outburst, they keep talking about, you know, how the Republican women are going to defect. Well, have we reached a point now where no women are going to vote for this guy?
Well, I think I've seen I've seen polls that show that there are actually fewer Republicans now than there were when Trump started running. So I think there's more independents now. People are leaving the party. You know, there is a core of, I think, 30% to 40% of the American electorate who has continued to approve of him and his behavior. But there's a good chunk of the American electorate that doesn't. So I'm hopeful. We'll see.
Well, Jennifer Machia, I thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Jennifer Machia. She's a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M University, where she teaches courses on political communication and presidential rhetoric, and a historian of American political discourse, especially discourses about citizenship, democracy, and the presidency. And she's the author of Founding Fictions and the co-editor of The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, Establishing the Obama Presidency. And she's finishing a third book about Donald Trump's presidential campaign and demagoguery. We're going to take a brief station break and back exploring both the constitutional authority of the President of the United States and the constitutional restraints imposed on his authority. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Corey Brettschneider, who is a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, as well as a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. He is the author of the new book just out, The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. Welcome to Background Briefing, Corey Brettschneider.
Thank you for having me.
And your book, in many ways, is really about how presidents should know and understand the Constitution. What's your sense of whether the current occupant of the Oval Office knows and understands the Constitution?
Not surprisingly, the book was motivated in large part by some of the outrageous proposals that Donald Trump had made during the campaign. For instance, the threat made good to try to shut down Muslim immigration, the threat to torture the families of suspected terrorists, not just the suspected terrorists themselves, the threat to change the libel laws, all those sort of amounted to me to not just individual proposals to violate the Constitution, but a sense that this president partly didn't know anything about the document and the basic rights that it guarantees, but also had a disposition really to see the Constitution as, or the rule of law more generally, as like real estate law, something to get around that lawyers could take care of and not a big deal. And so the outrage about that led me, originally I wanted to, I did write an article called Trump versus the Constitution, but I wanted to write a book that was more timeless and that focused on the, of course, the violations that are going on, but the bigger picture of how we keep this from happening in the future and how we could also stop a president who disregards the oath.
Well, so the book really does delve into the Constitution itself and the intentions of those that wrote it. And, of course, last week we saw the Kavanaugh hearings, and he's considered an originalist. And that seems to be a kind of guiding light, originalism, for the Federalist Society judges, of which he is one. So I guess in terms of originalism, I don't imagine that the Founding Fathers, in setting up the separation of powers with the judiciary, the legislative branch, and the executive branch, did they foresee a situation where we would have a very reckless and perhaps even dangerous executive, but a totally supine and enabling a legislative branch?
Yes, I think they did. I mean, they called such a person a demagogue, and there are frequent references to that idea that a president might come who doesn't know anything about the rule of law and doesn't care anything about it and might just cater to the whims and prejudices, really, the most base instinct of the electorate. And the way that they dealt with it was partly in Article 2, in the requirement in the first seconds of office that a president take an oath. And what the oath is to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, to subsume oneself, in other words, underneath the Constitution. And to understand, I mean, the point of making the president say that is to get the president from the second they are in office to recognize that they can't do anything they want, that they're limited in all sorts of ways by the original Constitution, and now I think we rightly say by the Bill of Rights as well. So, you know, the view, the so-called originalist view, I should say, that is a description of it, but certainly Kavanaugh, his beliefs when it comes to his extreme, or as I've called them in Politico, radical views of executive power, are really at odds with certainly what the framers thought they were doing with the document itself. And then I say, too, I'm critical of a kind of account of originalism that disregards the broad values of the Constitution. So I think on all the dimensions that matter, and then I would add another thing, of course, which is the case law that's developed over time to elaborate these protections, including U.S. v. Nixon. So Kavanaugh's skepticism of U.S. v. Nixon, or certainly his limiting of that case so that it would never apply again, to me is directly at odds with what the framers were all about and what the Constitution guarantees.
Well, but it's one thing to take an oath and another thing to follow an oath. And in Kavanaugh's case, it's pretty clear, at least to me, that the president chose him simply because he wanted to expand presidential powers and didn't feel that the president could be subpoenaed, and which is something that could happen with the Mueller inquiry. So at a time when we have a president who is somewhat recklessly and dangerously exercising executive authority, the idea that the swing vote, the next swing vote on the court, would give this man more power, to many, including myself, is a frightening prospect.
Yeah. I mean, one of the, you know, the book begins with this high aspiration of the oath and the duty of a president to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, not just not violate it, but go beyond that. But the last third of the book is, what do you do with a president who disregards the oath? How do you stop one? And one of the most important places, I think, is the courts. And you see this with the special prosecutor and the Mueller investigation. And, you know, we have to be clear what our resources are. And one is this terrific case, U.S. v. Nixon, exactly as you said, about the entitlement of a special prosecutor, the same system that we have now, to subpoena a president and to require information in a criminal trial. Kavanaugh, in his disregard of that case and his dismissal of it, and his really oscillation of views, I mean, at one point he's for very limited presidential power when he's prosecuting a president with Ken Starr, and then he's working for a Republican president and wants to aggrandize presidential power, you know, really is disregarding to me one of the fundamental checks that ensure that a president is not above the law, and really showing a lack, too, of the kind of judicial independence that we need from the judiciary. I mean, that case that I keep coming back to was 8-0. Eight justices unanimously said, we're not going to let Nixon basically get away with this. So part of the book is not just about subpoena power, but I go beyond that. Many people, many scholars say that a president can't be indicted while in office. And it's true that Alexander Hamilton probably had that view. He thought impeachment should come first. But I say the idea that a president is not above the law, the opposite of what Nixon said when he said when a president does it, it's not illegal, that demands that that a special prosecutor not only be able to subpoena, but also indict a president who has committed crimes. And Kavanaugh seems to have been picked exactly as you say, to undermine that possibility.
And again, I'm speaking with Corey Brettschneider, who's a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, as well as a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. He's the author of the new book just out, The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. And in your chapter on Article 2 and the limited presidency, you begin with a quote from Harry S. Truman. When you get to be president, there are all those things, the honors, the 21-gun salutes. You have to remember it isn't for you, it's for the presidency. And of course,
right.
We know that the current president has an outsized ego. And just last week at the UN, he showed it to the world, where he basically praised himself for being the greatest president and accomplishing more in 2 years than any prior president. And of course, that was greeted with derisive laughter from the world body. But what was so extraordinary about Harry Truman, and I wonder whether there's certainly nothing you can blame specifically on Trump, but the idea that Harry Truman, when his term was over, packed up the family car at the White House, and him and his wife and his daughter drove all the way back in the family car from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue to Independence, Missouri. What a different world we have in terms of the accretion of kind of royalty when it comes to our presidents.
Yes. I mean, I think that that symbol is so important and really goes back to the original idea of the limited presidency and the respect for the office that a president is supposed to have, and of course for the boss of the president, the American people, and the respect for the rule of law. And to me, you get it in that moment that you so nicely described. You also get it in Washington's, in the second inaugural address, his second inaugural, and of course the second ever, where he says, look, I just took the oath of office. It's 135 words, the shortest ever given. I just took the oath of office, requires me to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. But if I fail to do it, sort of acknowledging with this humility that the person is not the office, if I fail to do it, upbraid me, criticize me, and subject me to constitutional punishment. And I think what he's doing there is he's speaking to the, you know, small crowd assembled there, mostly members of Congress, but he's also speaking to the American people as a whole, talking to us now about our duty to know the Constitution, understand its limits. And the book is really written, of course, for future presidents, but more specifically for all of us to understand what those limits are and to demand of an arrogant, king-like president, or at least who has that ambition to see himself as royal, that this isn't the idea. And what he's doing is in direct violation of the oath itself, and not just that, the entire structure of the Constitution, which is a rejection of royalty.
So the former founding father, who has now has a Broadway show named after him, it's my understanding that he was the one of the founding fathers who was most concerned about the kind of passions of the mob and the idea that we could have a populist, as we do now with President Trump. So,
sorry, you're talking about Hamilton?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Do I have it right?
I think that he certainly had an idea of some limits on presidential power, and as I said, stressed the importance of impeachment. In the book, I'm more of a Madison person. They cooperated, and they wrote the Federalist Papers together, and they certainly agreed about the need for a constitution. But they disagreed, for instance, about some important things, and it's Madison that tended to stress the more limited presidency. So on the war powers, for instance, I think Hamilton might have been not as aggressive as current presidents, but more aggressive than Madison. I guess there was just a kind of deeper skepticism of the power of the president. Now, in practice, I think, too, it was Hamilton that stressed, dismissive, I think, maybe than Madison of limits on presidential power. But compared to where we are now, they were both heroes, so I wouldn't want to be dismissive of them. But I think if there was a hero of the book, it's probably not Hamilton. It's more Madison.
Well, what I was going to get at, though, and this is, and I may be wrong with my American history, but my understanding is that a part of the idea of having the Electoral College was a check on the passions of the mob. And
yes, that's right.
So that's what I'm getting at. That seems incredibly ironic that you would have this peculiar mechanism where the only country in the world that has two elections, one, the popular vote, which everybody in the rest of the world uses, and then a second election. And we know that that's going to come into play more and more as it has recently, deciding who gets president.
Point.
And, you know, this current president got over 3 million fewer votes than the person who lost, who actually won, but not because of the Electoral College. Now, the paradox of the Electoral College is that with the demographics in this country on the trajectory that they're on, by 2040, we will have a situation where 70 U.S. senators will be elected by 13 red rural states. And that is just bizarre. And, of course, that will mean that the Republicans will control the Supreme Court in perpetuity because they'll control the Senate. So that's where we're heading. We're heading into a situation where we'll have a very limited democracy, with the Republicans having a lock on the Senate and the courts, and the Democrats only being able to control the House and the White House. So
I agree with that. And, you know, I should say, too, that part of the idea of the book is that there are resources in the Constitution, core ideas that we need to cherish and hang on to and defend: the idea of free speech, religious freedom, equal protection under law, the limited presidency. But I certainly don't want to say that every aspect of the Constitution still works. And I think they thought, just as you said, that the Electoral College was going to keep a demagogue from getting elected. And we know now, of course, that that's not right. So I don't think we should be afraid to tinker with some of the mechanisms. I mean, I certainly don't want to tinker with things like the guarantee of equal protection under law, or birthright citizenship, or any of the things that Trump himself would want to do. I think he would dismantle the fundamental ideals of the Constitution. But I do think that taking seriously the idea of a move to the popular vote in the election of the presidency to avoid minority presidents being elected is a time that's coming. I mean, there are ways of doing it without amending the Constitution, too. There are efforts, for instance, to have legislation that does it at the state level without an amendment, where there'd basically be an agreement of all states to give their votes to the majority winner. And so I'm sympathetic about that, too. I think if we can figure out ways to use ordinary legislation to avoid the cumbersome process of an amendment, that we should explore them as well.
But what would the incentive be for these small red states with very few, you know, populations like Wyoming, to sign on to the National Popular Vote Compact?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, one thing might be that if there's a national movement and these start to pass in states, that you get a snowball effect. You know, we have to convince some of them to pass an amendment anyway, because you need two-thirds in order to ratify. So, you know, I guess either way, there are going to be obstacles.
Sure. Well, let's turn to some of the big questions just in the last couple of minutes here that are very much on the minds of Americans in the era of Trump. And remember, and with the point being that he is a minority president, He's only got about a third of the country at the most who are very zealously in support of him and are in a kind of Fox News bubble where they're immune to facts and information about that's contrary to what they're hearing. So these are the questions that arise. Can the President of the United States pardon himself? Can he fire anyone in the executive branch? Can he wage war without congressional approval? Or can a state like California develop a foreign policy on immigration and sign such things as international climate treaties?
Let me take a couple of those. On self-pardoning, I think absolutely not. I mean, the framers defended what they called, you know, mostly they broke up the prerogative powers of the king. So when we get to war, for instance, this is the most clear. The king could initiate war and carry it out in traditional monarchy. And the idea of the framers was we're definitely not going to allow that. We're going to split the power. So we'll let the president carry out a war, but the war can only be initiated or declared by Congress. And modern presidents have really been awful at disregarding that. So part of the book is about, again, using ordinary legislation to restore that original balance that would require the Congress to declare and the president to carry it out. And Democrats and Republicans, I think, have been, frankly, awful in disregarding that fundamental provision. They did keep what they called a benign power of prerogative, prerogative meaning the kingly absolute power. And so there was one area that they thought was almost absolute or almost a prerogative power, and that was pardoning. And I think they didn't imagine review of most of them, but there's one limit, and that's in the benign part. It has to be other regarding. And so a selfish pardon, trying to use it to protect oneself, is a violation of the pardon power, the benign idea that it's other regarding, of the oath itself, of course, which is about protecting the office, not protecting oneself. And so I think if he really tried it, the courts would stop him. Now, it's not just me who thinks that. Even Nixon's Office of Legal Counsel made that argument when they were asked if Nixon had the ability to protect himself. So I think at a lot of levels, common sense, the idea of the framers writing about this power as being a benign one, the oath, and actually also internal memos within the administrations themselves, even one very sympathetic, frankly, to somebody who wanted to pardon himself, that there's an understanding that this can't be done. And on that one, I'm pretty confident that if the president tried it, that the courts would ultimately reject it. And, you know, a lot of these controversies, we are in a constitutional crisis, and what it makes it one is that you have a president who is so thoroughly disregarding the oath and trying to use every aspect of his power to figure out how to subvert the rule of law. But ultimately, it's going to be courts that are going to make hard decisions like this. And I'm hopeful that, like in U.S. v. Nixon, that when it comes to the extreme abuses of power, that they'll stop this president. Now, I don't want to be naive, because if Kavanaugh gets on the court, if there are more appointments that are made, the balance might be tilted in terms of justices sympathetic to expansive presidential power. And that would not just be a constitutional crisis, it would be a grave one, because we would come out of it in a different way than we did during the Nixon administration. We'd have a Supreme Court unwilling to do its duty and stop a out-of-control president.
Well, Corey Breschneider, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. It's terrific.
And again, I've been speaking with Corey Breschneider, who's a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, as well as a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. And he's the author of the new book just out, The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Kathleen Ash and Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.